Well, thank you very much, David, for that introduction, and thank you for the welcome, everyone. Good morning, and great to be with you today. In many ways, the two enterprises I've been with this morning sum up so much of what I want to say. Family Action has been demonstrating for decades how a more personal and emotional approach to helping families, helping parents, helping mums and dads can actually help to build the stronger society that we all want to see and can solve so many of the social problems and problems of entrenched poverty that I'll be discussing today. Isildon, who are responsible for the building we're in today, a fantastic social enterprise, raising money commercially to spend it on the social purpose of helping young children, kids here in Islington, and an organisation that sums up what I've been talking about in terms of wanting a big society rather than a big state approach and helping to change lives as you do so. So thank you very much for all that you do. Thank you also for the parenting tips that I picked up this morning that with as my children about to enter their teenage years are going to be ever more necessary. Now this government is all about security. It's that security that underpins our long-term economic plan. In a world of risks, we want to ensure the British economy and British families are secure. It's security that drives our defence policy and our strategy to combat extremism. In dangerous times, we know our first duty is to keep our country safe. And it's national and economic security that is front and centre of my mind as I try to negotiate a better deal for Britain in Europe. But security is also what drives the social reform that I want this government to undertake in my second term. Individuals and families who are in poverty, they crave security. For them, it's the most important value of all. But those who are struggling often have no security and no real chance of security. Now, the economy can't be secure if we spend billions of pounds on picking up the pieces of social failure. And our society can't be strong and cohesive as long as there are millions of people who feel locked out of it. So economic and social reform, they're not two separate agendas. They're intimately connected to one another. And that social reform begins, as I set out 3 months ago in Manchester, with an all-out assault on poverty. Today I want to explain how we can transform the life chances of the poorest in our country and offer every child who's had a difficult start the promise of a brighter future. Now I think we should start by recognising the real achievements that have been made over many years in fighting poverty. We've seen huge progress over the past 50 years with rising living standards and big improvements in terms of people's incomes, their health, employment, education, and also a big improvement in child mortality rates. And of course, we've made progress in the last 5 years too. Since 2010 alone, the number of children growing up in workless households is at a record low, down by 480,000. And I often think that statistic says so much. 480,000 homes where suddenly a child has seen a mum or a dad going out to work. Think of the difference that that makes. And because we've got a strong economy, we can do more. But we know that despite the good news in our economy, there are still people left behind. And in particular, too many held back because of generational unemployment, addiction, or poor mental health. Now, of course, it isn't so much the dreadful material poverty that was so widespread in decades gone by, although let's be clear, some, of course, still exists. Today, it's more often the paucity of opportunity of those left behind that is the greatest problem. And in some of our country, people don't just get left behind, they start behind. They start well behind. Today in Britain, around 1 million children are growing up without the love of a dad. In Britain, a child born in a poor area will die an average of 9 years earlier than their peers. In Britain, there are more young black men in our prisons than there are studying at Russell Group universities. Now, these problems, they've been years in the making, and they will take time to tackle. But I'm convinced it doesn't have to be like this, and we can make a real difference. Now, in the spring, we'll publish our Life Chances strategy. We're going to set out a comprehensive plan to fight disadvantage and to extend opportunity. And today I want to set out the principles that are going to guide us. In doing so, I want to make a big argument, which is we'll only really make a real dent in this problem if we break free from all of the old, outdated thinking about poverty. And I want to explain how, by applying a more sophisticated and deeper understanding of what disadvantage means in Britain today, we can transform life chances. Now, the old thinking on fighting poverty, what I would call 20th century thinking, still dominates a lot of the political debate in Britain today. And there are sort of two schools of thought that have traditionally defined our approach. The first is the more leftist, statist view, built around increased welfare provision and more government intervention. Now, I'm not against state intervention. After all, I'm the Prime Minister who started the Troubled Families Programme, perhaps the most intensive form of state intervention that we've seen in recent years. And I support the welfare state. I believe the creation of those vital safety nets was one of the outstanding achievements of post-war Britain. But we know too that this approach has real limitations, and I think these have become badly exposed in recent years. The fixation on welfare, the state writing a cheque to push people's income just above the poverty line, this treated the symptoms, not the causes of poverty, and over time it trapped some people in dependency. Frankly, it was built around a slightly patronising view that people in poverty need simply to be pitied and managed instead of actually helped to break free. Now, the second approach is the more free market one, the idea that a rising tide will lift all boats. Now, I believe the free market has been by far the best tool ever invented for generating prosperity and improving living standards. And actually, applying its principles of more choice and competition to our public services has, I believe, disproportionately helped the most disadvantaged. But some people get left behind as the market transforms our economy and the rest of society with it. These people haven't been equipped to make the most of the opportunities presented to them, and a chasm exists between them and those who have been able to take advantage. Now, I believe in self-reliance and personal responsibility. I think it's absolutely correct, but we have to recognise that this alone is not enough. When it comes to people and poverty, a rising tide doesn't lift all boats. So if we want to transform life chances, we've got to go much, much deeper. So it's clear to me the returns from pursuing these two old approaches to poverty, they aren't just diminishing. In some cases, they're disappearing in our modern world. And we need to understand precisely why. Well, I think it's this. Both approaches had one thing in common. They focused on the economics and ignored the social. They missed that human dimension to poverty, the social causes, the reasons people can get stuck and become isolated. Let me put it another way. If you talk to a single mum on a poverty-stricken estate, someone who suffers from chronic depression, someone who perhaps drinks all day to numb the pain of the sexual abuse they might have suffered as a child, if you tell her her benefits have risen by a couple of pounds a week and so she and her children have been magically lifted out of poverty, or on the other hand, if you told her about the great opportunities created by our market economy, I think she'd ask you, well, what planet are you actually on? Of course, the economy is absolutely vital, and that's why we've got to see through our long-term economic plan. We're never going to defeat poverty unless we manage the economy responsibly, because in the end, it's always the poorest who suffer the most when governments lose control of the public finances. And of course, we'll never defeat poverty unless we back businesses to create jobs. Work is, and always will be, the best route out of poverty. And with welfare reform, universal credit, tax cuts, and the introduction of the national living wage, we're making sure that it always pays to work. And we'll continue to tackle the scourge of worklessness in Britain, including by reforming the way we support people who fall ill, so they can stay in work and aren't just consigned to a life stuck on benefits. And because the evidence shows that families where only one parent is in work are more at risk of poverty, we're going to back all of those who want to work. That's why our offer for working parents of 30 hours a week of free childcare for 3- and 4-year-olds is so important. But to really defeat poverty, we need to move beyond the economics. We need a more social approach, one where we develop a richer picture of how social problems combine, how they reinforce each other, how they manifest themselves throughout someone's life, and how the opportunity gap gets generated as a result. Above all, we need to think big, we need to be imaginative, not just leaving behind the old thinking, but opening ourselves up to the new thinking. For instance, the pioneering research that shows us why some children from poor families that can climb right to the top, while others seem condemned almost from birth to a life of struggle and stress. And there are four vital social insights that I believe must anchor our plan for extending life chances. First, when neuroscience shows us the pivotal importance of the first few years of life in determining the adults we become, we must think much more radically about improving family life and the early years. Second, when we know the importance not just of acquiring knowledge, but also developing character and resilience, there can be no let up in our mission to create an education system that is genuinely fit for the 21st century. Third, it is now so clear that social connections and experiences are vitally important in helping people to get on. So when we know about the power of the informal mentors, the mixing of communities, the broadened horizons, the art and culture that adolescents are exposed to, it's time to build a far more level playing field with opportunity for everyone, regardless of their background. And fourth, when we know that so many of those in poverty have specific treatable problems, such as alcoholism, drug addiction, poor mental health, when we know these things, we've got to offer the right support, including to those in crisis. This is what I would call a life cycle approach, one that takes people from their earliest years through schooling, adolescence, and adult life. And I believe that if we take the right action in each of these four areas, combined with all we're doing to bring our economy back to health, we can make a significant impact on poverty and on disadvantage in our country. And at the same time, it's right that we move away from simply looking at income-based poverty measures and develop more sophisticated social indicators to measure success. So let me set out in more depth some of the steps we're going to take in each of these four areas, and apologies in advance for the length of what I'm going to say, but I wanted to bring together in one place all the things that we aim to do in these four vital areas. So first, family and those crucial early years. Now, to me, families are the best anti-poverty measure ever invented. They're a welfare, education, and counselling system all wrapped up into one. Children in families that break apart are more than twice as likely to experience poverty as those whose families stay together. That's why strengthening families should be at the heart of our agenda. We've significantly increased the help we offer on childcare, introduced shared parental leave so families can be there for one another at the most stressful time, the birth of a child. We've backed marriage in the tax system, and 160,000 couples have taken up the preventative relationship support that we've funded over the last 5 years. And I can announce today that we'll double our investment in this Parliament with an extra £35 million to offer even more relationship support. We'll also do more to help people save, to help build families' financial resilience. Those with no savings at all have no buffer, no shock absorber for when the unexpected events hit. Saving is a habit that should start early, so we're going to expand the Church of England's Life Savers project, which helps primary school children to manage money and learn how to save. And we'll look at what more can be done in this whole vital area. So I can announce today that we intend to bring forward a help to save scheme to encourage those on low incomes to build up a rainy day fund. And full details of this scheme will be announced at the budget. All of this will help to prevent the relationship strain that can be caused by financial difficulties. But when it comes to life chances, it isn't just the relationship between parents that matters. It's what is just as important is the relationship between the parent and the child. Now, thanks to the advent of functional MRI scanners, neuroscientists and biologists say they've learnt more about how the brain works in the last 10 years than in the rest of human history put together. And one critical finding is that the vast majority of the synapses, the billions of connections that carry information through our brains, develop in the first 2 years. Destinies can be altered for good or ill in this window of opportunity. On the one hand, we know that the severe developmental damage that can be done in these so-called foundation years, when babies are emotionally neglected, abused, or if they witness domestic violence. As Dr. Jack Shonkoff's research at Harvard University has shown, Children who suffer what he calls toxic stress in those early years are potentially set up for a life of struggle, risky behaviour, poor social outcomes, all driven by abnormally high levels of the stress hormone cortisol. On the other hand, we also know, and it's common sense, that a safe, stimulating, loving family environment can make such a positive difference. One study found that by the age of three, some toddlers might have heard 30 million more words in their home environment than others. That is, I think, a staggering statistic. And of course, the more words children heard, the higher their IQ, the better they did in school, and also down the track. So mums and dads literally build babies' brains. We serve, they respond. The baby talk, the silly faces, the chatter, even when we know they can't answer back, the closeness of the contact, strengthening that lifelong emotional bond between mother and baby, this all matters so much for child development. The biological power of love, trust, and security. And yes, while bad habits can be passed on to children, we know too that the secret ingredients for a good life, character, delayed gratification, grit, resilience, they can be taught by parents, not just caught from them. So I believe if we're going to extend life chances in our country, it's time to begin talking properly about parenting and babies and reinforcing what a huge choice having a child is in the first place, as well as what a big responsibility parents face in getting these early years right. Now, of course, that must begin by helping those most in need. And that's why I've made it such a priority to speed up the adoption process and improve child protection and social services. I think these will be landmark reforms of the next 5 years. But there's a lot more we can do. Our Troubled Families programme has worked with 120,000 of the hardest to reach families in the country, helping to turn their lives around by getting parents a job or getting children into school, ending truancy, dealing with the problems that they face. Over the next 5 years, we'll work with 400,000 more families. And as we do that, I want us to be much bolder. It is tragic that some children turn up to school unable to feed themselves or use the toilet. Now, of course, this is a clear failure of parenting, but by allowing poor parenting to do such damage for so long, it's also a state failure of social services, of the health service, of childcare, of the lot. So I can announce today that as we scale up the Troubled Families programme, we'll ensure that parenting skills and child development become central to how it is both targeted and how it's delivered. Now, in the end, though, getting parenting and early years right isn't just about the hardest to reach families. Frankly, it's about everyone. And we have to work at it. If you don't have a strong support network, if you don't know other mums or dads, having your first child can be enormously isolating. As we know, they don't come with a manual, and that's obvious, but is it really right that all of us get so little guidance? Now, we've made some good progress. We've dramatically expanded the number of health visitors, and that, I think, is crucial. But it deals with one particular part of parenting, the first few weeks and months. What about later on, when it comes to good play, communication, behaviour, discipline? All issues I was struggling with at the weekend, and I expect many of you were too. We all need more help with this, because it's the most important job that we'll ever have. So I believe we now need to think about how to make it normal, even aspirational, to attend parenting classes. We should encourage the growth of high-quality courses that help with all aspects of becoming a great mum or a great dad. And we need to take steps to encourage all new parents to build a strong network, just as brilliant organisations like Family Action or NCT already do for some parents. So I can announce today that our Life Chances strategy will include a plan for significantly expanding parenting provision. It will examine the possibility of introducing a voucher scheme for parenting classes, and it will recommend the best way to incentivise parents to take them up. Now, if families fail, it is even more critical that schools do not. And that, of course, is the second part of our strategy. When a child has had a difficult start, what could they need more than a place of sanctuary, warmth, challenge, escape, liberation, and discovery? Now, if they're lucky, they can find it in an outstanding school with dedicated, inspiring teachers. So what we need to do is take the luck right out of the equation. And that's what our reforms have been all about, bringing the best schools to some of our most deprived neighbourhoods, as well as bringing real rigour, like phonics, back into the classroom. I remember the battle we had to get phonics taken up, and it reached something of an apogee in success for me when, picking up my five-year-old from school, I was actually told by my teacher, do more phonics practice at half-term. And I thought, yes, this reform now is fully embedded in our country. And I did do some. But there are today 1.3 million more children in good or outstanding schools today compared with 2010. And over the coming weeks, I'll set out in more detail our second-term education reform agenda. But let me explain some of the thinking that will underpin it and how, in particular, we want to help the most disadvantaged children. We now understand far more than we used to about how we take in information and how we learn and what it takes to be a great reader or even to be creative. Much of the answer is knowledge. We understand new information in the context of what we already hold. As Kahneman, Daniel Willingham, and others have described, the more information is stored in our long-term memory, the better our processing power, our working memory, can be employed. It is by knowing the past that we can invent the future. That is why it's so absurd to call a knowledge-based curriculum traditional. It is utterly cutting-edge, because it takes real notice of the great advances in our understanding of the last few decades. Dismissing knowledge is, frankly, dismissing the life chances of our children. And frankly, that is exactly what people like the General Secretary of the NUT are doing when they say, as she did last weekend, that children don't need to learn their times tables because they can use their phone instead. That is utterly the wrong thinking. All the things that knowledge helps infuse, innovation, creativity, problem solving, those are the qualities that our employers want. And that is why the EBAC, which puts the core subjects of English, maths, science, history, and geography at the centre of what students learn, is actually not just the right curriculum, it is a massive move for social justice in our country. It will give the vast majority of children, not just the wealthy, the education that gives them the opportunity for great jobs. And we also understand something else. Character, persistence, is core to success. As Carol Dweck has shown in her work at Stanford, no matter how clever you are, if you don't believe in continued hard work and concentration, and if you don't believe that you can return from failure, you will not fulfill your potential. It is, if you like, what the Tiger Mother's battle hymn is all about. Work, try hard, believe you can succeed, get up and try again. It is, if you like, the precise opposite of an all-must-have-prizes culture that permeated our schools under the last government and for so long. Put simply, children thrive on high expectations. It's how they grow in school and beyond. Now, for too long, this has been the preserve of the most elite schools, and I want to spread it to everyone. So as we reform education, we'll develop new character modules so that all heads are exposed to what the very best schools do. We'll learn from new schools like the Floriat Primary Schools in Southall and Brent that will teach character virtues like curiosity, honesty, perseverance, and service. We'll commission great trainers, teachers, and youth workers to share and create materials and make sure they're available to every school in the country. We will also do more on sport, one of the extracurricular activities most associated actually with high academic achievement. Our new sports strategy extends Sport England's remit to cover five-year-olds and upwards, meaning more children taking part in sport and experiencing the highs and, let's be frank, often lows of competition, both inside school and without. And when it comes to formative experiences that build character, there can be few more powerful examples than National Citizens Service. NCS is now becoming a rite of passage for teenagers all over Britain. It helps them mix with people from different backgrounds, helps them learn to work together, helps you to push yourself further than you ever thought possible. NCS is about showing young people the power of public service and not just self-service. And so I can make a major announcement on this today. We're going to provide over £1 billion for NCS over the next 4 years, meaning that by 2021, NCS will cover 60% of all 16-year-olds. It will become the largest programme of its kind in Europe, And to get there, we'll now expect schools to give every pupil the opportunity to take part, and we'll tie NCS into the national curriculum. This is a significant investment in future generations, and because it will help build a stronger, more integrated and cohesive society, it is one, I believe, that will make us all very proud. Now, the third part of our Life Chances strategy must be to make opportunity more equal. Not just continuing to reduce youth unemployment, getting more people to university, reducing the scourge of discrimination. Of course, we should do all of those things. That's why, for instance, just a few weeks ago, I persuaded leading businesses, universities, organisations across the public sector to adopt name-blind applications, because I want every young person in Britain to know that they'll be judged according to merit, not lazy and inaccurate stereotypes. But I'm talking about something more subtle, but no less influential for life chances. There's a book called Our Kids by Bob Putnam, which is dominating the American political debate on poverty. And it seeks to explain why the college-educated professional classes continue to move ahead, while those at the bottom can remain stuck. And it describes a whole series of advantages that those at the top have, but can be lacking in others. The informal networks of support, the mentors, the social connections, all helping to give young people those soft skills and extra advantages that they need to navigate the fast-moving seas of the modern world. And when you add all these advantages up, it's no surprise that there's an opportunity gap between the rich and the poor. The work that active, demanding parents do is fantastic, passing on life-enriching experiences to their children, and rightly being unapologetic about helping them to get ahead. And it's only natural that parents, we all use our experience and our social networks and connections to give kids the best start in life. So my starting point for this is not to ask, how can we stop some parents giving their children a brilliant start? That would be an absurd starting point. What motivates me is helping the most disadvantaged kids to catch up. Let me give you a few examples. Work experience for school children can be a transformative opportunity. It gives children the chance to experience work, to talk to adults who aren't just authority figures like parents and teachers. And at its best, it can really help teenagers establish a network and encourage them to think completely differently about their future. Now, it often does that for those lucky enough to arrange a great placement. But for so many, it either doesn't happen at all, or it's just a wasted week, sometimes spent locally, just watching the clock, never getting kids out of their comfort zone or raising their sights to the height they should go. Now, we can change that, and later in the spring, we'll set out a plan for using work experience much more creatively, especially for the most disadvantaged young people. There's also the opportunity of culture. Britain is blessed with some of the most awe-inspiring cultural treasures on our planet. Museums, theatres, galleries, exhibitions, artists, musicians, they are a jewel in our country's crown. And culture should never be a privilege, it is a birthright that belongs to us all. But the truth is, there are too many young people in Britain who are culturally disenfranchised. And if you believe in publicly funded arts and culture, as I passionately do, then you must also believe in equality of access, attracting all and welcoming all, rich and poor, culture vultures, first-timers, in London and outside London. And this doesn't just mean opening up a few times to children from a deprived area. It means taking all creativity and ingenuity of those who work in the arts and applying it to this vital challenge. And we can learn from those organisations that already do an excellent job in reaching out to marginalised groups. So again, our Life Chances strategy will address this cultural disenfranchisement directly with a new cultural citizens programme and ensure there's real engagement by arts organisations with those who might believe that culture is not for them, meaning that many more children can have the doors opened to their wonderful cultural inheritance. Mentoring should also be a big, big part of our plans. Many people look back at their younger selves, their younger lives, and they can point to someone or remember someone. Maybe it was a parent or a teacher or a sports coach or even their first boss, and say, that's the person who really found my passion. That's the one who made a difference for me. But if you haven't ever had someone in your life who really believes in you, who sees your potential, who helps bring it to the fore, the sands of time can drain away and your talents can remain hidden. So I can announce that we're going to launch a new national campaign led by Christine Hodgson, chairman of Capgemini UK and the Careers and Enterprise Company. And it will work with business, charities and the public sector to build a new generation of high-quality mentors. We'll direct £70 million towards careers in this Parliament, principally to the Careers and Enterprise Company, who'll lead this major new effort to recruit mentors for young teenagers, with a focus on the 25,000 about to start their GCSEs, who we know are underachieving or at risk of dropping out. I've seen this happen. Some London state schools, one I went to a couple of years ago, where every single child coming up to GCSE had a mentor. And I think we can be far more ambitious about what is possible in this area. So by finding inspirational role models and encouraging them to give up some time, I believe we can really help young people make big plans for their future. There's also an important issue of community that we must address, and that is some of our housing estates. Some of these places, especially those built after the war, actually entrench poverty because of the way they isolate and entrap so many families and communities. Now, of course, within these estates, behind the front doors, families build warm and welcoming homes just like anyone else. But step outside and you're often confronted by concrete slabs as if dropped from on high, brutal high-rise towers, linked walkways that become a gift to criminals and drug dealers. These places actually design in crime in some cases rather than design it out. Decades of neglect have spawned ghettos, gangs, and antisocial behaviour. And poverty has become concentrated because, let's face it, few who could afford to move would want to stay. Now, of course, these estates also lead to social segregation, meaning people from different backgrounds just don't mix together as much as they used to. And that isn't good for anyone. So I think it is time to be far more ambitious about solving this problem. So I can announce today we're going to tear them down. We're going to work with 100 housing estates across the country, aiming to transform them. We'll work in partnership with residents, housing associations, local authorities, social enterprises, private developers, and sweep away the barriers that prevent regeneration. Now, for some estates, it will mean simply knocking them down and starting again. Developers will rebuild, often at a higher density, increasing housing supply throughout the country. And to help us get there, we'll appoint an advisory panel whose first job will be to establish a set of binding guarantees for tenants and homeowners so they know they are properly protected. With massive estate regeneration, tenants protected, land unlocked for new housing all over Britain, I believe we can truly consign the term sink estate to history. Now, the final part of our plan must be to get the right treatment and support to those who are in crisis. Some people with mental health problems today are almost guaranteed to live a life in poverty. And the number of people who suffer from poor mental health is much larger than many think. One in five new mothers develop a mental health problem around the time of the birth of their child. Up to one in four of us will have a problem, perhaps a form of depression or anxiety, this year alone. There is the terrible fact that suicide has become the leading cause of death for men under 50. And the challenge is that all too often, people are just left to get to crisis point, either because the health service simply can't cope, or because they're worried about admitting to have a problem in the first place. So we've got to get this right. Mental illness isn't contagious. There's nothing to be frightened of. As a country, we need to be far more mature about this. Less hushed tones, less whispering, more frank and open discussion. We need to take away that shame, that embarrassment. Let people know that they're not in this alone, and that when the clouds descend, they don't have to suffer silently. I want us to be able to say to anyone who's struggling, talk to someone, ask your doctor for help, and we'll always be there to support you. But that support has to be there. And that obviously poses a big challenge for government in terms of services and treatment. We have to be equal to it. So that's why last March we announced an unprecedented £1.25 billion investment in mental health treatment for children and young people. And this is already improving talking therapy services for children across the country, although if someone can come up with a better name than IAPT, please do. It is one of the least memorable acronyms in government, but it is one of the most important programs that we've put forward. So we're going to use that money to intervene much earlier with those suffering from poor mental health so we can stop problems escalating. And I can announce today a £290 million investment by 2020, which will mean that at least 30,000 more women each year will have access to evidence-based specialist mental health care during or after pregnancy. But crisis doesn't hit at convenient times, but people with mental health problems are three times more likely to turn up at A&E than those without. So today I can commit a further £250 million to deliver 24/7 psychiatric liaison services in A&E departments, ensuring that people with mental health receive assessment and treatment, whatever the reason for their attendance at A&E. This is happening at the best hospitals. We want it to happen much, much more in future. We'll also invest £400 million to enable teams across the country to deliver 24/7 treatment in communities and homes as a safe and effective alternative to hospitals. We'll deliver a guarantee that more than half of patients with psychosis, the most serious cases, will be treated within 2 weeks. And for teenagers suffering from eating disorders like anorexia, we're introducing the first ever waiting time standards so that more people can get help within a month of being referred or within a week for urgent cases. Now, with these announcements, by breaking the mental health taboo, by working with businesses and charities, and by taking forward the recommendations of the Independent Mental Health Task Force that will soon report, I believe we can lead a revolution in mental health treatment in Britain. But there is one last issue we need to address, and that is addiction. Alcoholism and drug addiction can happen to anyone. People with wonderful families, great careers, with a million good reasons to stop. Now, in Westminster, we were reminded of this all too painfully last summer. Charles Kennedy was not just a brilliant MP with so much more to contribute to our politics and public life. He was also a kind, lovely man, brimming with wit, warmth, and humanity. He was starting a new life in a place that he loved. He had everything to live for. But at just 55, he was gone. So are we getting it right here? Are we looking after each other as we should? I really don't think that we are. And let's be honest, when we hear those words, drug addict or alcoholic, there is still such a stigma that comes attached. Still a view that addiction is simply a question of will, a sense that it's simply about self-control, a feeling that somehow it's shameful if we have to admit to having a problem. We see it as weakness, and it isn't. Seeking help is strength. Now, let me be clear. I believe profoundly in personal responsibility. Personal responsibility means facing up to problems and seeking treatment and doing everything you can to get back on the right track. And we should always emphasize that. And we should never make excuses for addicts' behavior, especially when they commit crime to support a habit or if they hurt those around them. But when we know more, as we do now, about how addiction works, how it changes your brain structure, how some people are genetically more susceptible, how stress and depression can make you more likely to develop a problem, we can understand why this is so difficult. We've got to start treating people with the compassion that we would want to receive if it was one of our own family who had fallen into this difficulty. And that's why we've already changed our approach so that recovery, rather than maintenance, is now the key goal of drug treatment. And I can announce today that we're going to create a new social investment outcomes fund of up to £30 million to encourage the development of new treatment options for alcoholism and drug addiction delivered by expert charities and social enterprises. I think this could unlock around £120 million of funding from local commissioners and up to £60 million of new social investment to expand the kind of treatment that we know can work, including those vital residential rehab places. I think it is a perfect use of social impact bonds. We all know the money that can be saved from these sorts of creative interventions. And I hope to see a real expansion of this in the years ahead. So this is how I believe we can rescue a generation from poverty and extend life chances right across our country. It's about backing stable families and good parenting because we know the importance of those early years and setting children up for a good life. It's about improving education so those who've had the toughest starts have every chance of breaking that cycle of poverty. It's about building a country where opportunity is genuinely more equal, with stronger communities and young people who have the experiences and the networks that others might have to help them take on the world. And it's about providing high-quality treatment as we eliminate once and for all the damaging stigma that surrounds addiction and mental health. Now, all of this, delivering our Life Chances strategy, it starts with a fundamental belief that people in poverty are not liabilities to be managed. Each person is an asset to be realised, human potential to be nurtured. Now, since I first got to my feet here this morning, some time ago, you might say, 40 babies have been born in our country. Newborns being bundled up and handed to proud parents in maternity wards all across Britain. Picture that in your mind. Remember the first time it happened to you. And think of the hope in those rooms, the quiet wishes being made by mums and dads, rich and poor alike, for that precious bundle's future. And sometimes we can make politics sound very complicated, but for me it all comes back to a simple ambition, to give every child the chance to dream big dreams, and the tools, the character, the knowledge, and the confidence that will let their potential shine brightly. So for people in Britain who are struggling today, our mission as a government is to look each parent and child in the eye and say, your dreams are our dreams. We'll support you with everything we've got. And with the steps that I've outlined today, our Life Chances strategy, I'm confident that we can deliver. Thank you. Thank you very much.